An English court recently had to decide whether to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to Sweden to face rape charges. Discussing Assange's interactions with a woman known as AA, the court said, if AA had made it clear that she would only consent to sexual intercourse if Mr. Assange used a condom, then a jury could hold that there would be no consent if he did not use a condom. Subsequent legal judgments appear to suggest that someone can consent to sexual intercourse on the condition that their partner doesn't ejaculate inside them, or on the condition that their partner is a cisgender man. According to the Crown Prosecution Service, these judgments suggest a developing concept of conditional consent, but the CPS notes the absence of clear authority as to how far the concept extends. Legal commentators, Gavin Doyle and Andrew Watley, likewise observe that the courts must now address whether the concept of conditional consent ought to be extended to other situations. Now, these recent judgments cast doubt on previous judgments in which the courts had held that sex was consensual despite breaching the consent giver's condition for their partner not to have HIV, or that they were married at the time. Perhaps the most famous of these older judgments is Lineker, in which a condition of the prostitute's sexual consent involved payment. You'll notice from the handout I'm using the word prostitute, only with some reservations. We can talk about that in questions if people are so inclined. Unfortunately, the case report of Lineker leaves the precise details of the condition unclear. One leading criminal law textbook describes it as a case in which payment was the condition of consent. And that's the version that's on your handout as Lineker payment. Other commentators have described it as a case in which it wasn't the payment, but rather Lineker's promise of payment, which was the condition of consent. Despite these disagreements over the details, it's clear that after having sexual intercourse, Lineker absconded without paying, and the court held that the sexual intercourse was nevertheless consensual. So the question I'm going to be primarily concerned with is this. Should the developing concept of conditional consent in cases like Assange be extended to cases like Lineker? So I should say that I won't be attempting to answer that in a yes-no sort of way, but I'm going to be attempting to provide a framework in which I hope that, you know, that might be useful for the courts in trying to answer this question. But let me say a little bit about why I'm trying to do that. The reason I'm trying to do that is because the existing academic literature leaves the answer to this question unresolved. And I think that's because the contributors to that literature differ in their intuitions about cases like Lineker. So some commentators have the intuition that there's an important difference between cases like Assange and those like Lineker. And while they might be prepared to believe that sex in breach of a condom-wearing condition is non-consensual, they find it hard to believe that the same is true of sex in breach of a payment condition. And instead, these commentators tend to suggest something like this, that the wrong in cases like Lineker is not the wrong of non-consensual sex, but is instead the wrong of non-payment, which some say, so for example, Joel Feinberg says something like, this is more a matter of a contract than criminal law. So that's one group of commentators. The other group of commentators have different intuitions about Lineker in cases like it, and they believe that there's no morally relevant difference between someone consenting on the condition that their partner wears a condom as opposed to consenting on the condition that their partner pays them afterwards. They think that sex in breach of either condition is non-consensual. Roughly, I think the thought is that liberal sexual morality requires us to respect whatever conditions that individuals impose on their own consent in light of their own conception of the sexual good. Now, there are clear differences between Lineker and Assange. Firstly, the prostitute's consent, unlike AA's and Assange, formed part of a bilateral agreement in which she was supposed to receive something in return, namely money. And the law often treats bilateral agreements of a certain kind as contracts. And that, I suggest, is what tempts commentators to think of those kinds of cases in terms of contracts. And the second important difference is that the condition in Assange, the condom-wearing condition, was supposed to be satisfied at the same time as the sex, whereas the payment Lineker was supposed to be satisfied afterwards. And that's led some people to suggest that it couldn't really be a condition of consent at all. So to decide whether a concept should extend from cases like Assange to cases like Lineker, we need to decide whether these two differences are morally relevant. And to decide that, we need to know two things. These are on your handout. There's one and two. First, we need to know how conditional consent can form part of bilateral agreements, including contracts. And second, we need to know whether someone can place conditions on their consent where those conditions occur, if at all, only after they're purportedly consented to activity. Now, I should say a bit here about methodology. Since people differ in their intuitions, as I've already said, we can't appeal to those intuitions directly to try and solve this, to answer these questions. And so to avoid dialectical impasse, what I'm suggesting is that we instead start outside of the sexual domain and we think about non-sexual cases and how we place conditions on our consent in those cases. And I'm going to be drawing a distinction between two different ways that we can place conditions on our consent. And then I'm going to move back into to use that distinction and apply it to the sexual domain and come back to think about what we can learn about the legal cases from there. I think one benefit of that account is that it's going to be continuous across both the sexual and non-sexual domains, and so hopefully it will help us make sense of many everyday cases in which we place conditions on consent in non-sexual cases. Okay, so roughly, I'm going to outline two different ways in which some people place conditions on their morally valid consent. The kind of big picture, intuitive picture is that roughly you can, one kind of condition restricts what you consent to, and the other kind of condition restricts whether you consent at all. I'm going to be talking about these in terms of the language in your handout. I'm going to be talking about them in terms of the normative scope thesis and normative force thesis, but I'll introduce those properly when we come to them. And then I'm going to return, as I said, having come via the non-sexual cases back to the sexual domain. Okay, so first, what's the standard picture for how we place conditions on our consent? Well, what's the standard picture of sort of non-conditional, unconditional consent, if you like? Well, that picture is embedded in a story about rights. And so the thought is this, that we have rights, or claim rights, if you like, over our persons and our property, and by giving our morally valid consent, we can waive some of those rights while keeping others in place. So this brings me to the normative scope thesis. This is on your handout. So according to the normative scope thesis, by restricting the content of their consent, a person restricts the normative scope so as to waive more specific rights. So a bit needs unpacking here. So firstly, there's the notion of content. Secondly, there's the notion of normative scope. So the content of someone's act of consent, I'm going to say, it's a bit of stipulative terminology, it's the set of rights that person purports to waive by performing that act. And the normative scope thesis, as stated, is going to be neutral on what fixes the content of someone's consent. So you might think it's fixed by their intentions, for example, or by the content of their speech act. I'm going to assume for ease of exposition that it's the content of a speech act. I think probably you can make the same case even if you think it's fixed by their intentions. That's not the same as normative scope, as the act's normative scope. So recall that the content is the set of act that the set of rights they purport to waive, but for the simple reason that they might not have all of the rights that they purport to waive, they might be unsuccessful. So the normative scope, if you like, you know, if I consent to you touching my arm and taking this pen, and then it turns out that this pen belongs to someone other than me, then I can't consent to you. So the thought is that the normative scope in these kinds of cases is going to cover just the right against you touching my arm. Good. Right, so there's a general important lesson here that I can't waive a right that I don't initially possess. Okay. And then one final thing to say, an act of consent can sometimes lack normative force. This is also on your handout. And those are the sorts of cases I have in mind, is where I say, I hereby consent to you touching my arm, but only because you have a gun to my head. And those are cases, I'm going to say, that have content. I'm saying you can touch my arm rather than borrow my car. But I don't succeed in waiving those rights. I don't succeed in releasing you from the correlative duty because of the way that it's induced by coercion. And that's going to be something parallel is going to be true for deception and so on. So I'm going to assume that there's no coercion or deception or lack of capacity or anything like that going on in any of the cases that I'm going to be talking about. Okay. So, recap. General theory of rights. We can waive some of those rights by giving our consent according to the normative scope thesis. And we're going to waive some of our rights but leave others in place. Now, there are lots of examples in which you can think that actually, in a sense, even these so-called unconditional cases are going to involve conditions of a certain kind. If you think of me having rights over my person and my property, then I can say, I consent to you touching my arm, but I can rephrase that as I consent to you touching my body on the condition that it's my arm that you touch. And I can consent to you entering my flat on the condition, my property on the condition that it's my flat and not my beach house and so on. Now, I mean, it's true that you can rephrase things that way, but that's probably not terribly interesting. I'm interested in the sort of moral phenomena here. But the general moral picture is one in which someone's waiving an ever more specific right by consenting. Now, I'm going to suggest that there's a widely held view of rights on which the normative scope thesis can't account for all of the cases in which it's intuitively possible for someone to place conditions on them without their consent. And that's because there are cases in which you can place conditions on your consent despite not possessing the very specific right in question. So I'm going to put a case to you that hopefully is an intuitive case of that kind. It's on the second page of your handout. Reds. So the Reds are a sports team, and on Monday, Elliot says to Beau, "You may enter my apartment on Friday if the Reds win on Wednesday." Now, to explain Reds using the normative scope thesis requires us to treat it as a case in which Elliot restricts the content of her consent, thereby restricting the normative scope of her consent, so it's a more specific right. But to waive a more specific right, Elliot must possess that right. And that means that the specific right she must possess is something like the specific right that against Bo entering her apartment on Friday if the Reds win on Wednesday. And I think lots of people think that they find it very counterintuitive that you might have rights of that kind. Roughly on that kind of view, our possession of specific rights follows from our possession of more general rights, only when they contain the same or very closely related interest. So you might think that from the fact that Alia possesses general rights over her property, it follows that she possesses more specific rights over certain parts of her property, over entering her beach house and her apartment and so on. And similarly, from her rights over her body, it follows that she has rights against people touching specific parts of her body. But it doesn't follow from that she has these very specific rights against her, that are linked to very unrelated events, like whether certain sports teams win, or whether today is a Tuesday, or whatever. So, if that's right, then, I should say that precisely which rights someone has, which specific rights an individual possesses, is going to be a difficult question. I'm not really trying to fully answer that question, but this is trying to give you a flavour of the sort of view that I have in mind. So I'm going to assume that Reds is a case in which Alia possesses the general right against Bo entering her apartment, but lacks the more specific right against Bo entering her apartment on Friday if the Reds win. You can feel free to substitute other cases if you think that's the most important one. Okay, so if that's true, then that kind of case can't be explained by the normative scope thesis for the simple reason that that Ali doesn't possess the divine right. But there's good news, which is that I think that this can be explained another way, and I think this can be explained as a case, as an application of what I call the normative force thesis, and that's also on your handout. And so the normative force thesis says this, that by placing conditions on the illocutionary force of their consent, someone can place conditions on the normative force. So someone's locutions has the illocutionary force of consent, just in case it expresses the intention to waive a right by hereby expressing that very intention, and it has the normative force, as we saw earlier, just in case it successfully waives that right. So I think that, roughly, I'm going to suggest that the power to place conditions on the normative force of our consent protects the same, or a similar valuable interest to the one that's protected by our power to revoke our consent. So to see why, to give a sense of why we have that kind of power, we can think about cases like surgery, which I think is on your handout. So I say to my surgeon, only if my daughter arrives before I go under the knife do I hereby consent to operating on me. Well, the thought here is that if I were to go under the knife, you know, if just before the surgeon was about to make the incision, my daughter hadn't arrived, and that was the reason why I chose to revoke my consent, I can say, hang on, doc, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, and I would have thereby extinguished the normative force of my previously given consent. And that's because it's in my interest to control whether the doctor wrongs me in those circumstances. Now, if through certain circumstances, so for example, maybe the operation has to be done under general anaesthetic, that interest remains equally strong. There's nothing about the fact that I'm under general, you know, it just means that I'm now less able to protect it. So the thought is, well, if I know beforehand that I don't want the doctor to operate if my daughter hasn't arrived, then I should be able to say, well, you know, I'm going to say in advance, you can only operate if she's arrived. Okay, so I think that, and of course, you know, the mechanism here is supposed to be something like this, that I'm explicitly adding an additional condition on the at will on the illocutionary force of my consent, and I think that that's the sort of thing that we see in other places too. So I'm thinking of Dorothy Edgington's work on conditional commands, for example, in which the doctor says to the nurse, you know, on the condition, if the patient's alive in the morning, I hereby command you to change the bandages. Edgington says, well, the speech act has the illocutionary force of a command to change the bandages, conditional upon the patient's being alive. It's not a condition, say, you know, it's not a command of the material conditional, for example, a command to either make it the case that the patient's not alive in the morning, and similarly, Margaret Gilbert has some work on conditional promises, and Gilbert says something that she calls an externally conditional promise has that kind of structure. If the condition's not satisfied, there's no illocutionary force of a promise at all. Okay, so we're now in a position, happily, to explain cases like Red's. In Red's, Ali imposes the condition on the illocutionary force of their speech act. She's a right against both entering her apartment. Her locution, that's the illocutionary force of reporting to overwrite, if and only if the Reds win on Wednesday. And since illocutionary force is a necessary condition for normative force, by imposing a condition on the illocutionary force, Ali imposes a condition on the normative force. Right. I'd better hurry up. Okay. So those are two different ways I'm going to suggest that individuals can place conditions on their consent. But to answer the question about whether we should extend the doctrine or the concept of conditional consent in cases like Assange, in cases like Lineker, we still need to answer those two questions about how consent can fall into part of bilateral agreements like contracts and about timing. So I'm going to talk about each of those. Okay. So, so there are two kinds of bilateral agreement that are going to be of particular interest to us, especially given the ambiguity in the report about Lineker. In the first kind, one person makes the normative force of their consent conditional on the other person performing some action. So you have a case on your handout that's dishes beforehand. So on Monday, Alex says to vote, on the condition that you wash the dishes on Wednesday, I hereby consent to you entering my apartment on Friday. So here, Alia makes the illocutory force of her consent conditional upon very performing an action, it's washing the dishes, and since illocutory force is a necessary condition, the normative force, it's effectively a condition of the normative force of her consent. Now we've got two options in this situation, either Beau washes the dishes on Wednesday, if he does, then Alia and Beau have an agreement. And the second possibility is that Beau doesn't wash the dishes, but nevertheless enters Alia's apartment. And if that's true, then there's no agreement because we haven't satisfied the condition of the agreement. No illocutory force, so no normative force, and so he doesn't have permission to enter the apartment. And if that's true, then if he does enter the apartment, wrongs Alia by infringing her right against his entering her apartment. Now, there's a different kind of bilateral agreement in which someone makes the normative force of their consent conditional on the other person promising to perform some action. So not doing it, but promising to do so. And that's the next case on your handout, dishes promise. So on Monday, Alia says to Beau, I consent on the condition that you promise to wash the dishes on Wednesday, I hereby consent to entering my apartment on Friday. Now I think this is a rather different case to the first kind, because if you like, once Beau has promised to wash the dishes, he satisfied the condition of that second kind of agreement. So now, if he doesn't make the promise and walks into the apartment, he's committed the wrong of trespass. But if he promises, he has satisfied the condition of the promise, they have an agreement, he's got the permission to enter the apartment. But if he nevertheless, then doesn't wash the dishes, the wrong he's committed is breach of promise, rather than trespass. Let's try and stick ahead. So I think this is, I suggested this early on, that the law treats certain kind of agreements as contracts, and so it's tempting to think of these kinds of cases as contracts. But I think contracts, I think it's relatively uncontroversial to say that contracts require agreements, bilateral agreements. And so it's not the case that both of these kinds of cases involve contracts. I'm going to suggest that dishes promise might involve a breach of contract, but dishes beforehand doesn't, because, if you like, there's an agreement in the dishes promise, whereas there's no agreement to a breach in the dishes beforehand case. Skipping ahead so that we get the conclusions in. So leaving aside the question of these two kinds of agreements, there's also this question. So this is the way we've just done the question of how consent can be embedded in two different kinds of bilateral agreement. Just suggested, only one of them is actually a successful agreement. There's now this question of timing. And so there's this question of whether it's possible to make the normative force of someone's consent conditional on an event that occurs, if at all, only after the purportedly consented to activity. And so we can consider a variation on the dishes cases. Dishes afterwards, this is also a good. So on Monday, Alia says to Beau, if you wash the dishes on Friday, I hereby consent to you entering my apartment on Wednesday. Now, for all I've said about the normative force thesis, it's possible for Alia to place just that kind of condition, and indeed I think she can place that kind of condition on her consent, but I think this strikes some people as a little bit strange. And I think that's a mistake, and here's why. So I think the concern about these cases goes, roughly speaking, something like this. Unless Alia's consent has a normative force when Beau enters her apartment, wrongs her by doing so, and according to the normative force thesis, it's a necessary condition on the normative force that her speech act has the illocutionary force, and since the conditional illocutionary force is satisfied, if at all, only after Beau enters the apartment, Alia's consent has normative force, if at all, only after Beau enters the apartment. I think that's roughly the concern. I'm going to suggest that that kind of concern relies on something like the timing thesis, that's also on your handout, which states the speech act has the illocutionary force only when the conditions on its illocutionary force are satisfied. And I think some people find that intuitive, many people find that intuitive, and subscribe to it at least implicitly. Though several people have convincingly argued, in my view, some of them sitting in this room, that the timing thesis is false. So I'm going to suggest that it's false as well, really just drawing on their work here. I'm going to suggest that it's false, but it's plausible, it sounds plausible, I think, because it closely resembles a claim that is true, namely that a speech act has illocutionary force only if the conditions on its illocutionary force are satisfied, but not only when. So you can consider a case of delayed receipt. I think this is on your handout too. This is a variation on a case of Halley Liberto's. So Adam writes a note on Monday promising Bertha that he'll not buy Whistler's father, a painting that Bertha detests, and Bertha receives a note on Wednesday, and on Tuesday, so before Bertha's received the note, Adam buys the painting, and intuitively he's supposed to think, he's breached his promise. And I think that's plausible by buying the painting on Tuesday. Now, if the timing thesis is correct, of course, it can't accommodate that intuition. So I think this is the sort of case that could make you think that the timing thesis is false. It's true that it's only, don't be a promise only if Bertha received the note, but not only when Bertha received the note. And to get the only if intuition going, you could think, well, what if Adam had intercepted the note before Bertha received it? Would he have then breached the promise? I think it's plausible to think that he wouldn't have. Now, if all of that's true, then I think we can say something parallel in the case of consent, which is to say that, I mean, it's controversial, but so far I've been assuming that consent requires the same kind of speech act that promises require. And on the assumption that that's true, we can say the parallel thing about consent, that it's important that there's an act of consent only if, but not only when, the conditions on the illocutionary force is satisfied. Okay, so if that's true, then there's no temporal constraint on the conditions on the illocutionary force of the speech act, and that, I think, is a welcome result. Right, so if that's right, then we can explain dishes afterwards. Both washing the dishes on Friday is a condition that Alia places on the illocutionary force of her consent to go entering her apartment on the Wednesday. The illocutionary force of an act of consent is a necessary condition for its normative force. That condition is also a condition on normative force. And Bo has Alia's morally valid consent to entering the apartment only if he washes the dishes on Friday. Okay. So now I want to come back to the legal implications and back to the sexual domain. Use some of these distinctions to try and help make sense of the Assange and Lineker type cases. So I'm going to suggest that distinguishing these two kinds of ways of placing conditions on your consent can help make sense of the law and help us provide principles for how to decide future cases. I'm going to proceed on the assumption that non-consensual sex is a serious moral wrong, and the core function of the criminal law is to criminalise serious moral wrongs, typically by making them the actus reus of a criminal offence. Okay, so let's see if we can make sense of what's going on. Well, on the normative scope thesis, to use that kind of mechanism for placing a condition on your consent, if you possess the specific right in question to begin with. So the first question to ask in each of these legal cases is whether a consent giver possessed the specific right in question. If they did, then possibly they use an normative scope thesis or something like that. So consider Assange. AA had a general right against Assange having sex with her, and plausibly she also had the more specific right against Assange having sex with her on the condition that she wore a condom, or in more natural language, if you like, we say that AA plausibly had a specific right against Assange having protected sex with her, and if that's true, then plausibly she waived a specific right against protected sex, leaving the specific right against unprotected sex in place. And if in those circumstances Assange had unprotected sex with AA, then he did something other than what she consented to. That case is like the one in which I consent to you touching my arm, and you do something other than touch my leg or something. Right. So what's done is outside of the scope of the consent. So now consider Lineker. Well, recall that unfortunately the case report is ambiguous, so let's think about the two versions back on the first page of your handout. Well, in the case in which, what have I called here, Lineker payment, well, we need to ask whether the prostitute possessed a specific right against sex on condition of payment, and if yes, then it's possibly an application of normative scope thesis. Put in more natural language, that's the possession of a right against paid sex. That kind of right, you can plausibly waive it by leaving your right against unpaid sex in place. And then, by having unpaid sex, that would mean something that Lydia would be doing something that's outside of the scope of what's consented to. But what if there was no such right, there's no right against paid sex? Well then, even in that case, it seems like the prostitute would have possessed a more general right against Lineker having sex with her. And here, what might have been going on is an application of the normative force thesis, which is to say, and here our discussion of bilateral agreements and dishes afterwards and so on is going to help us. Timing thesis is false, then it doesn't matter that payment was subsequent to the sex. Instead, the case is structurally like dishes afterwards, just like, so in that case, remember, Ali's consent to Bray's entering her apartment was conditional on him later doing the dishes, and illocutory force is a necessary conditional normative force. So if all of that's true, then it's a case like that, in which the payment was a condition on the illocutory force of the consent, and illocutory force is a necessary condition of normative force, so if he didn't pay afterwards, then there's never any normative force of the consent. And of course, engaging in sexual activity when someone's consent has no normative force is another way of having sex with them without their normal right of consent. Okay, so that's true if Lineker was as the first version, Lineker payment. What if it's Lineker promise that's how things happened? Well, in that case, then the case is one in which the condition was that Lineker promised to pay afterwards, and then the case looks a lot like Dish's promise. So, provided that Lineker made the promise, maybe sincerely, then the wrong is not the wrong of non-consensual sex, but the wrong of breach of promise. And I think that's the sort of thing that tempts people to say that we should think of these cases in terms of breach of promise or contract, in which case Lineker does plausibly owe something like the money back or something like that. I mean, there are general principles of contract law that could kick in at that point. And I think that can explain the situation that Lineker is more a matter of the contract than criminal law, that kind of example. So I think this helps explain also the differing intuitions about the legal cases involving conditional consent. So remember that some Some commentators have the intuition that there's an important difference between consenting on the condition of payment and consenting on the condition that a partner wears a condom. Well, I think that if what I've said, or something like what I've said, is correct, then we might be able to see how we can vindicate those intuitions as correct. It will depend, basically, on whether the individual possesses a specific right in each of these cases. If the individual possesses a specific right against protected sex, but not against paid sex, then the former cases are explained as applications of the normative scope thesis, and the latter explained in terms of the normative force thesis, and that might be an important difference. But recall also that the commentators in the second group had the intuition, you know, when someone's partner reaches either kind of condition, payment or condom use, they're both cases in which someone has sex with their partner without their morally valid consent. And my argument might also vindicate that argument, or that intuition is correct. Because even if there's an important difference in the way in which these conditions are placed on their consent, breaching the conditions in either way will result in non-consensual sex. So if that's correct, then on the plausible assumption, I think, that the wrong of non-consensual sex is the kind of wrong that the law ought to criminalise, then I suggest that the law ought to be extended to criminalise non-consensual sex placed using the normative force thesis, as well as the one that it currently does, the normative scope thesis. I think I should probably leave things there.